You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Our guest is Professor Timothy Hoff, who has just published a book about the threats posed to clinical medicine by what I'll call Medicine 2.0, the corporatization of healthcare. The book's title says it best. Next in line, lowered care expectations in the age of retail and value-based health. Dr. Hoff is professor of management, healthcare systems, and health policy at Northeastern University here in Boston, and a visiting scholar at Oxford University across the pond. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Hoff.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Your new book is grounded in interviews with roughly 40 primary care physicians and 40 patients. As you explained, this wasn't quantitative research. It was qualitative. That is, it was aimed at arriving at some practical conclusions. Could you give us a brief overview of your principal takeaways?
Really, what I found, I think the biggest takeaway was that, you know, this concept of the doctor-patient relationship, which is extremely important to a good healthcare system. We know that from research. We know that from common sense. We know that from decades of sort of seeing it in action ourselves as patients. What I found is really that relationship and the whole notion of relational care within the healthcare system is sort of, I would put it as under assault from a blend of forces that, you know, define the industry now, from everything from what I call metric fever, which is the heavy use of performance measurement and data analytics to drive care, to the emphasis on efficiency and transactional care, this idea that, you know, pump more volume through the system and worry less about the quality of what you're doing. And then also the introduction of, which is a more later event, retail thinking, this idea of sort of the Walmartization of healthcare. So my takeaways is that, you know, if we don't sort of reverse this trend soon and really take a look as a system, as a society, about what we really want from healthcare, particularly this notion of the doctor-patient relationship, we'll find patients with much lower expectations of what they're supposed to get from healthcare, which my book already shows. We'll see more providers and doctors unhappy and dissatisfied as to the kind of system they're working in, and the potential to turn healthcare into just another, what I call, sort of cheapened set of transactions that define a lot of our lives now is very possible. So I think my book is kind of a warning shot
Yes.
that we need to really wake up.
You mentioned in the course of explaining the principal takeaways, you mentioned quality, and you think that you fear that the quality might be lowered. That's kind of paradoxical, though, isn't it? Because one of the things that's measured to fairly well now is quality and the number of check boxes checked and the number of things accomplished. So how do you reconcile that? I mean, is the quality going to come down even though people are busy checking things off?
Well, you know, I do a lot of research on quality care, and you know, one is, you know, we use this word quality now, we sort of throw it around, and I would say, what do we really mean by that word? What we mean now in the system too often is this notion of standardized care that's designed to sort of meet this minimal baseline of appropriateness, right? Mm-hmm. So the diabetic patient gets the exams done, gets the regular checkup, gets, you know, the provider gets paid for that, the provider looks like they're providing high quality care if they do those transactional things. But the provider gets less credit for, less payment for, and we measure less whether the provider treats every diabetes patient as a unique individual with unique needs, with a unique life story. And, you know, those things affect how the diabetes patient trajects their disease over time. It affects whether they stay healthy. It affects whether they comply with their care. So these things like trust, these things between doctor and patient, empathy, the ability to communicate and have time to communicate, you know, sort of the soft skills, the relational skills. We know from research that these things are really important in producing a high quality health experience over time for patients. And those things, unfortunately, are not really valued that much anymore in the system. And so that's what I mean by, you know, yeah, we might comfort ourselves and think we've checking all these boxes, but, and I hear this from doctors all the time, you know, are those checked boxes really the full definition of quality? I don't think so.
Well, so you've written an indictment of the current direction of primary care. And so how do you answer the criticism that your view of the doctor-patient relationship is a kind of nostalgia for medicine 1.0?
I guess you could see it as kind of nostalgia, although I think the difference is, as opposed to just writing something where I'm sort of giving my opinion, I think the book is lays out a pretty systematic analysis. You know, through the voices of doctors and patients and their everyday experiences now in the system, about what that relationship is becoming and how it's being interfered with by these, you know, forces that surround the patient care environment each day, the corporatization of care. So, yeah, I think some of it may sound nostalgic, but it's backed up by really good, I think, research and evidence. And so in that sense, if it's nostalgic but systematic, I have no problem with that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask this question. Could clinicians, as opposed to physicians alone, establish trust with patients? In other words, if the cultural, and there's a big cultural aspect to this, if the cultural dimensions of physicians change, is it possible that the nurse practitioner, the physician's assistant, the person that one sees on a regular basis, can one establish trust there?
Sure, absolutely. But right now we have a system where, you know, the cultural legitimacy, the legal legitimacy, right, is still accorded to doctors.
Right.
So that's a really important point to keep in mind. I mean, we're the social contract and the legal contract is not between a patient and a medical assistant or a patient and a nurse. It's between a patient and their doctor. And so that's really the essence of the relationship we still need to look at on, you know, if and until the cultural norms shift. You know, maybe in 10 or 20 years, we won't see physicians as the most central part of the relationships we have to have in healthcare. But right now, I would argue they're the best trained. They're the ones who are licensed, and they're the ones that we have 100 years of sort of history with in terms of our connection as patients with them. I also think my fear is when we talk about other providers, it's not that there can't be good relational care with other providers like nurse practitioners. The problem is many of these non-physician providers are growing up under the aegis of corporate care and organized care. And they're sort of employees of those sorts of settings. And so, you know, our ability to develop real, trusting, long-term relationships with the same nurse practitioner or same physician assistant over time, you know, that's going to be questionable given that a lot of these non-physician providers may be working in, you know, retail clinics or, you know, organized settings where they frankly are asked to follow guidelines and they are not able necessarily to always develop continuous relationships with patients. Now that may change, but you know, we know why organizations use a lot of these non-physician providers sometimes. It's because they cost less.
Yeah, right. As you said, the physician is seen as a high cost input into the system. But I mean, taking a kind of a dangerously broad view, We've had these relationship with physicians since they were known as shamans, probably, and so these are the people who guide us through birth and death, right, and through the sort of the medical hazards of life. Maybe that's changing in a fundamental way. I mean, the Amazonization of things is that, well, you know, where'd you get the book? I got it on Amazon. I didn't get it from from Penguin Press or my local bookstore. I got it through Amazon. There's a big cultural, strong cultural winds at play here.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And, you know, my pushback to that is always, well, let's ask the question, is healthcare really like buying a book or buying a toaster or buying a television?
Right.
You know, it's fine to see the, you know, retail thinking and this idea of, you know, you don't need interpersonal dyadic relationships, you know, in shopping for trampolines on Amazon. I mean, I don't need to know someone at Amazon. I don't need to have them. I don't need to trust them because I trust the company that they're going to deliver the trampoline. And that's really all I want. It's a transaction. It's a point in time purchase.
Right.
Healthcare is a lot different, I would argue. Healthcare depends, and keeping people healthy and happy over their life course depends on these attributes of good relational care, you know, the things like trust, dialogue, mutual respect, empathy, compassion. Organizations don't have a good history of being able to provide those things to their customers. And so, again, does it have to be the doctor? Well, maybe in the future, no. But, you know, as my book points out, the patients I talk to, they still expect it to be the doctor.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we need to and doctors still expect themselves to be the people. And so if the two most central parties in the healthcare system believe that to be true, then I think we need to listen to that. And let me say, I think, you know, the patients that I interviewed, for example, in specialty care and in surgical care, I mean, those patients expected less of the relational medicine, right? You know, mm-hmm. They talked about, hey, I go to a surgeon because I need something specific done. We already know usually what needs to be done. I want them to be good technicians. I don't need to have this long-term relationship. So I think really where we're talking about this doctor-patient relationship quality is really in the primary care area, because that's really where people expect to have, you know, someone to help them and guide them and be there to talk to when they feel vulnerable. Now, again, could it be a care navigator? Could it be even a really well-trained medical assistant? For some things, yes. But, you know, again, you know, if we value the sake of training and experience and education and that sort of thing, then it really is the doctor.
One of the things that you mentioned is the physicians trading off their, not consciously, but in effect trading off their cultural legitimacy for on the altar of prestige and prestige cars and vacation homes. In other words, they're trying to preserve income as opposed to cultural legitimacy.
Yeah, so, you know, I did a book a few years ago called Practice Under Pressure about primary care. And in that book and also in this book, I sort of allude to, based on the data I saw in talking with doctors, that, you know, physicians are under the gun. You know, they're scrambling. They're trying to maintain themselves and their way of life within a context that's increasingly, you know, hostile towards their interests and towards paying them. And so I get it. But physicians, you know, have made a lot of short-term tactical decisions to try and preserve maybe their economic standing, for example.
Yeah.
But what are the costs of those short-term tactical decisions long-term for their legitimacy with the public? For example, too, when doctors go to work as employees for hospital systems and large practices, which in primary care they're doing now in waves, you know, I'm not sure they realize they become employees. And the organization then is able to basically become the face of care for the patient. It's not them anymore. So those kinds of decisions, while I understand them, we all make them in every occupational area of life. Those are risky, and I think the medical profession as a whole has probably been overly fixated on things like the economics of healthcare, when in fact really the key to it all for them long term is whether patients see them as the right relational source of legitimacy and care for themselves. If they don't, then the economics of the situation will get worse for them very quickly.
You know, you mentioned kind of in passing the idea of collective bargaining by physicians as a survival tool. I found that intriguing.
Yeah, I did. I did a little research about 12, 13 years ago on physician unionization, you know, back sort of at the tail end of the managed care era. You know, at the time, it wasn't really a concept whose time had come yet. But I wonder, you know, I say in the book, you know, one of the things doctors are going to have to do is, so few doctors now belong to the AMA, and this whole idea of working for your professional association, you know, that's certainly a route to try and gain back the ability to fight for things like relational care and time and stuff like that with your patients. But I think as more physicians are employees within organizations, they're cut up into groups, isolated groups. And I think they're going to have to think more of collectively mobilizing within those sort of organizational areas. Tufts, you know, had doctors that were thinking of unionizing, you know, a while back. And I think the laws will start to change. You know, traditionally doctors couldn't organize because they were seen as managers or supervisors. But increasingly, as they're paid employees, I think you may find that their legal ability to organize will change. So I do think that they are going to have to come together in a different way, because right now they're fairly scattered and many of them don't belong to the professional associations. And so how are they going to fight for their interests collectively otherwise?
What do you hope that clinicians and patients will do to get to the next step? You know, call it medicine 3.0. Well, what features does your research tell you they would most value?
Well, I think, you know, there needs to be certainly a pushback by patients. I think part of it has to be, you know, this sort of unlocking of the patient perspective. And we give a lot of lip service to that right now in healthcare, this idea of patient-centered care and the patient experience. But the way we're doing it, in my opinion, you know, and I'm also a business school professor, I mean, so I study this stuff, the way we're doing it as an industry is wrong. And it serves more of the organization's interests. It enables them to brand themselves when they can do a patient satisfaction survey and show that all their patients are satisfied because they answered one question correctly. So I think we need to really empower and engage patients more and really get them to understand more that their view, especially now that they're paying more and they're more directly involved in their care with all the insurance changes. So that's one thing, this idea of, you know, what do patients really want? And then how do you get the industry to act on it? And I think that stuff would become more economically valued if patients pushed harder and said that they want it. Because, again, healthcare is a marketplace. So if third-party payers and hospitals see that patients are making choices based on things like, you know, am I going to have a relationship with a doctor in this setting? They may alter the way they do things to accommodate that. And then I also think, you know, the whole quality movement, which I think already is starting to be questioned, right? This whole overabundance of standardized metrics and cookbooks, which doctors have been talking about rightly for two decades about the negative effects of it. I think we're going to see sort of a pushback on that. And I think that will provide an opening for, okay, what other things can we measure? What other things can we start to look at in the workplace? For example, trust. I mean, you don't see trust really being given its due in terms of the measurements that are out there or what NCQA looks at or what, you know, all these different incentive systems look like. Mm-hmm. But if we could really start measuring trust and actually tracking it and actually understanding that it comes about through long-term relationships that get established and then ascribe an economic value to that, I think, you know, all it takes is little things like that. Unfortunately, the saying, you know, we value what we measure is really the flip of what it's supposed to be, which is we measure what we value.
All right. Before we go, I want to make sure that the listeners know the title of your intriguing book. It's called Next in Line, and it's published by Oxford University Press. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Dr. Hoff.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
That was our 215th edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. Kristen Kelly is the executive producer here for the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.